following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay. So today we're going to talk about, basically Babylon, Babylonian Jewish community. The yeshivot, very important part of Jewish history, the first, the earliest and most important diaspora community in Jewish history is certainly Babylon. Before we talk about it, I just want to finish up sort of what is going on in the land of Israel. Last class we talked about, right, the Mishnah and the Talmud, Jerusalem Talmud, which is finished in the mid-4th century. Okay, I want to talk about, now Israel, from this period of time onward, until we get more or less to Zionism and modern history of Israel, Israel's sort of going to disappear from the scene of Jewish history, practically, physically. Obviously, spiritually, Jerusalem and Israel never disappears from the hearts and minds of the Jewish people. Especially when in the diaspora, Jerusalem is an ideal, even though not a physical reality, for the vast majority of Jews who obviously never got to visit this place. It was very far away in terms of the reality of the idea of a Jewish state, of even coming to visit for most of Jewish history. Travel back in the ancient world, Middle Ages, was a very difficult thing. So certainly in the hearts and minds of the Jewish people, Jerusalem was always there. Okay, and there was never a period of time when there wasn't some Jewish population living in the land of Israel. As a matter of fact, up north in the Galilee, there's a place called Piki'in, a village, where there's actually a few remaining Jews, the only Jews to claim that they never left the land of Israel. Very interesting. People like to study how the Hebrew they speak, to see, you know, do they speak the original Hebrew? It's obviously not legitimate, as it's gone through huge, talking about hundreds and hundreds of years, so who knows how accurate the Hebrew they speak in terms of ancient Hebrew. But there's always a Jewish presence here. Okay, Jews always wanted to come here. Jews always tried to come here. But from this period of time onward, we're talking about the last 1,500 years, the Jewish population of Jerusalem is going to dwindle. The whole population of the Holy Land is going to dwindle. But especially the Jewish population is going to go down greatly due to the very difficult economic, political circumstances here. And for all practical purposes, we're not going to talk too much about Israel, except when we talk a little about the Crusades, etc., but not really talk too much about Israel until we get to the modern period when Jewish presence really begins to be established in any significant way. So just sort of to end off with what happens to the Jews in the land of Israel, remember we mentioned that, you know, 4th century, Rome becomes Byzantine. Okay, Byzantine meaning, remember, Roman Christian? During the Byzantine occupation of the land of Israel, which is going to go from mid-4th century until early 7th century, because then the Muslims, or the Persians come in for a few years, they're thrown out again, but then the Muslims are going to come, and from early 7th century onward, around 638 onward, until, with the only break being the Crusades, from 1099 to 1187, except for that break, we're going to have pretty much 13 centuries of Islamic, I'm not saying Arab, because some of these people are not Arabs, like the Turks, but Islamic rule in the land of Israel, with a small Jewish population, some Christians here, some Jews. But during the time from when Rome becomes Byzantine until Rome, the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, loses the land of Israel to the Muslims when they expand in the 7th century, there's a Jewish population here, which actually is a very significant population. We think of like destruction of the Second Temple and Bar Kokhba as the end of Jewish settlement in the land. It's not true. There actually is a very significant Jewish population here in the 4th, 5th, and even 6th centuries. Okay, not necessarily in Jerusalem, because that's pretty much going to be a Roman pagan, as we said before, and then Byzantine city. Once Christianity takes over, Jerusalem is going to become a very important place for pilgrimage for Christians because of the sites in the New Testament associated with the life of Jesus, etc. Okay, but Jewish population in the land of Israel, we know for a fact that early Byzantine period there was a large Jewish population, and because of that, you know, the land prospered, as we say, and there's a lot of agricultural activity, both Jewish and Byzantine, at that period of time. But the Byzantines, now being Roman Christians, are going to have an added problem dealing with the Jews, because before we just had the pagan Jewish problem. Now we have this idea of a new religious worldview that's competing with us, this replacement theology I mentioned. And Jews are going to continue to have like the status of a hostile people. But in addition, we're going to have a new Christian perspective on the status of the Jews throughout the Roman Empire and in the land of Israel. And basically the policy taken by Byzantine, meaning Christian Roman emperors towards the Jews, was we're going to preserve the status quo. we'll allow them to stay. You know, whatever rights and privileges that we had them have before, we'll allow them to have them. We certainly don't grant them anything new. Let's not let them build more synagogues. Let's keep them pretty much where they are, static. And in the land of Israel, it's a situation I mentioned last class, in the 3rd century, before Christianity comes on the scene. There's a lot of chaos in the Roman Empire throughout the 3rd century. The whole population of the land of Israel is going to decline. Economics is going to be very bad. And even afterwards, it might recover somewhat, but the situation is going to be very difficult economically and politically for the Jews in the land of Israel. And because of that, Jews are going to look for greener pastures, which is, by the way, a great pattern in history for Jewish migration. When things get bad for the Jews, even in the land of Israel, our most important spot, Jews will migrate elsewhere. What are the factors that it will always attract Jews to migrate elsewhere? It's obviously going to be... Sorry? Right. Place where they'll be tolerated, ideally wanted in some level because of our ability to contribute economically and culturally and whatever. And a place where we can prosper economically. And that's going to be the great pattern. Things heat up in a certain area, whether it's anti-Semitism specifically directed at the Jews or just that a certain country or geographic area is not pleasant for the Jewish people for whatever reasons, we'll move on. So the story of pretty much the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries is the beginning of the end of really significant Jewish inhabitation in the land of Israel until the rebirth of the state of Israel and the aliyot, the large immigrations that are going to take place in the late 19th and early 20th century. Just a little bit of information, not to go into all the details, but... You know, we talked about the Talmud is finished in the mid-4th century. What happens in the mid-4th century? The Byzantines don't allow the Sanhedrin to sit anymore. Now, it says in Tractate Rosh Hashanah, remember we talked about the Sanhedrin moving around? I'll just read you. It says in Rosh Hashanah, it says that the Sanhedrin was exiled from Jerusalem to Yavna, to Usha, and from Usha to Shfaram, to Beit Sha'arim, from Beit Sha'arim to Tzipori, remember that's Yehuda Nasi I mentioned, the guy who puts together the Mishnah? And from Tzipori to Tiberias. The last place the Sanhedrin sits in the mid-4th century is in Tiberias. That's where I say they put together the Jerusalem Talmud. Of course, the Jerusalem Talmud isn't put together in Jerusalem. It's put together in Tiberias. The point being is all these places, I don't have a map in front of me to show you, all these places are in the Galilee. Okay, or in that area. That is the main center of Jewish population. That is where the rabbis sit. That is the center of Jewish cultural life, economic life, and religious spiritual life. Tiberias, the last place the Sanhedrin sits, is going to cease to be the seat of the Sanhedrin by 363. In 363, the Roman authorities, after the death of Yehuda Nesia III, his son Hillel II, okay, he's the last guy to preside over the Sanhedrin, the Roman Byzantine authorities no longer allow the Sanhedrin basically to have any power or authority. For all intents and purposes, it ceases. Doesn't mean there aren't going to be Jews learning Torah in the land of Israel, and they're not going to be yeshivas here, but no longer any one body that's the central body that the diaspora community will look to for decisions. By the way, what's the most important decision the Sanhedrin has to render? Anyone know? There's one extremely important thing the Sanhedrin does. Yeah. Very good, very good. Calculation of the months. A little known but very important factor in Jewish history and keeping Jewish calendar is months. When the Sanhedrin existed, we're talking about for a period of centuries, all throughout Jewish history, from the time we leave Egypt till the 4th century of the Common Era, to declare a new month. Witnesses would come before the Sanhedrin and say, I saw the new moon. They'd be interrogated. The Sanhedrin would then say, it's now a new month. Okay, it's a very interesting topic. Why we have some Rosh Chodeshes are 2 days, some are 1 day. It all dates goes back to this idea of if they didn't see the new moon, they will retroactively sometimes make the day before the beginning of the new month. I don't want to go into it now. It's a very interesting topic. And already in the whole Second Temple period, when there was a large diaspora community in Babylon, you know what they would do? They would declare a new month and they would light bonfires on the major mountain peaks going all the way down to Iraq. There'd be a series of bonfires lit, literally going hundreds and hundreds of miles away, so that people would know that in a few hours the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem had declared a new month. Very interesting, considering there's no telephones, no email, no faxes. How do you know it's a new month? And it only worked when there was a Sanhedrin and there was a diaspora in which the Jews were relatively close. Iraq is certainly a lot closer than Australia. Okay, today we could do it with email and whatever. The world's a much smaller place in terms of communications, but we don't have a Sanhedrin to do it. Knowing the new month is absolutely essential. It's not just a technical point, because we as Jews sanctify time. Time is extremely important. Okay? And if there's disagreements as to when the new month is, and if you, God forbid, get different Jewish communities, the Christian calendar has a huge problem. Gregorian versus Julian calendar. Eastern Orthodox Church does not keep the same dates as the Western Roman Catholic Church. Until this day, their holidays are at different times. Okay? Errors in calendrical calculations can cause significant problems, which will not only throw your whole calendar off, but will also make it that you could have splits in the Jewish world where different people are keeping different calendars. God forbid that happens. That's the end of unified Judaism. Yes, sir?
Yeah, but we already have so many different Minhagim as it is.
Minhagim is one thing, no problem. Calendar dates that you keep Rosh Hashanah a week after I do, forget it. That's it.
Who's going to argue with the new moon when we can make astronomical calculations?
So Max is asking, who's going to argue with the new moon when we make astronomical calculations? It's not a question of we can't figure out the moon. We have to have a body that decides this is the new month. It's not so clear when the new moon is. It could be off by a day, depending on when you see it, if it's cloudy.
Right now?
No, now. Let me talk about what happened now. Okay. Now I'm not talking about it. But the idea, it's not just the question of the technical side of it. It's the idea of the Sanhedrin has to say it's so. Lo bashamayim hi. It's not in the heavens. The court has to rule this is the new moon. Even with mathematical calculations in modern astronomy, if we had a Sanhedrin today, they would get together and decide when the new moon is. And even if it disagreed with what the astronomy says, we'd hold by the Sanhedrin. Very interesting idea. Very interesting idea in halacha, that the court fixes the date. And that's more important, that the Jewish people follow a central authority than we go according to the opinion of one person or even what's before our eyes, which is not a topic for this class, but it's a very interesting idea in terms of unity of the Jewish people. If the Sanhedrin can no longer sit, and then who's going to fix the calendar? So what does Hillel II do just prior to the disillusionment of the dissolving of the Sanhedrin? He, using basically mathematics, sets up all of the Jewish calendar from then onward. What we use today is the calendar put in place in the 4th century by Hillel II. Very important. So that's one of the last vital acts of the Sanhedrin. Yes, Jeff?
This thing called Torah Tipton.
Yeah.
You always write for every month. Here it says 136. This means that the moon is likely to be visible on Thursday evening, which would mean if we had a Sanhedrin today, it would probably proclaim Friday as Rosh Chodesh. We'd actually match up this month. What do they mean?
Right, meaning that because of their calculations not being, this is a great example. When they announce when the new moon is, okay, is not, doesn't match exactly astronomy. It's off slightly. It's off slightly, but we hold by, this is a great case. We don't hold by modern astronomy for this. We hold by what the Sanhedrin fixed, which is a much more important, and again, the important is not exactly the exact hour when the moon is in the exact position when it will be a new month according to Jewish calendar. The point is that we're holding by the decision of the Sanhedrin. That's much more important than the astronomy involved in it. Okay, which is a very important thing. We have to realize that we're keeping by a calendar that was put in place many, many, many centuries ago. Yeah?
Well, isn't that why we have 2 days?
Anyway, the 2 days is more of a zecher, a remembrance of what could have been.
Yeah.
I don't want to make this a class on Jewish calendar, by the way. So if anyone wants to know more information, I have a lot of information on it. But it's a very important thing. We don't realize how important having a unified calendar is for the Jewish people. So that's what they do. So Sanhedrin no longer exists by mid-4th century, which corresponds to when the Yerushalmi Jerusalem Talmud more or less is finished, because it's no longer an authoritative body to even work on that document. Again, there are still Jews in the land of Israel, people still learning Torah. But that means the diaspora no longer can write back to Jerusalem for answers from the Sanhedrin. This is really the beginning of a diaspora where there's no longer central authority. A very different situation than the diaspora that exists during the Second Temple period. For as bad as things were in the land of Israel during Roman occupation, in Babylon they always knew that there was a Jewish Supreme Court in Jerusalem. By 425, after the death of Gamaliel VII, the Roman Emperor, the Byzantine Roman Emperor, Theodosius II, okay, he dissolves the position of the Nasi. He says, I no longer recognize that position. Which means not only is the Sanhedrin gone, but a recognized position by the Gentile authorities who represents the Jewish community in the land of Israel no longer exists either. That's the end of the line of King David, his descendants of the Nasiim in the land of Israel. So you don't have a Sanhedrin, you don't have a person you recognize having authority anymore, and therefore really Jerusalem is going to slowly slip from the scenes of as central to the Jewish world.
Why did he do that?
The reasoning behind it, political, the Romans basically had enough of the Jews by that period of time. We don't need to recognize you anymore. The situation was so bad. I can look up more specifically what exactly was going on in the mind. I don't know if he wrote it down, if any chronicler wrote exactly what was going on. But it's not unusual. In a period of time when you get an emperor who doesn't like the Jews anymore, why should I recognize you or your position anymore? We don't need you anymore. There's barely any of you left in the country anyway. So that's the end of central authority. Now, I mentioned this many times before, the idea of God makes the cure before the disease. Right? God makes the cure before the disease. Whenever we're going to get to a situation, having the land of Israel for the first time in well over 1,000 years, ceased to be the center of the Jewish world because there's no longer a court here, could be the end of the Jewish people. But already we see that hundreds of years before, that there's already going to be a strong diaspora community in Babylon, which is going to be able to compensate for the loss of Jerusalem. Okay, and again, doesn't mean Jerusalem is going to disappear from our minds. It's going to be there. In Babylon, they turned to Jerusalem to pray also. But this is really going to be the rise of the Babylonian Jewish community. And if you look at your little charts here, and we flipped over the pages here to the middle, the Jewish Middle Ages we're in now. We're in the first little box here of our suitcase, and you see a little map of the Middle East. And we're going to talk about a period which is, we call it the 500 years of centralized Torah authority in Babylon. Okay, Babylon is now going to rise to be the great Jewish community that is going to compensate for the loss of Jerusalem and Israel. And it's really going to be for many centuries, the vast majority of Jews are going to live in that area of the world. Just to step out a little bit and look what's going on in Babylon before we talk about the Jewish community. I mentioned through many, many classes that this is, along with Egypt, one of the earliest great civilizations of the ancient world. Okay, we say writing probably originated there, the cradle of civilization between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. We're talking about the civilizations that have lived there for centuries, starting with Assyria, then going to the Babylonian Empire. And then we talked about during the Purim story that the Persians and the Medes come in. There are several different Persian empires. In the in the mid-4th century, we're going to have, in the 3rd century, we're going to have the Sasanian, which are the new Persians, are going to take over the old Parthian Persian Empire. And that's going to be the dominant Persian Empire that's going to be there for the next several centuries. Okay, so we're talking about this period of time. We're talking about Jews living under the Sasanians, okay, who are also Zoroastrians. We're talking about this dualistic religion. I mentioned this before, right? When we talk about the religions that were popular in the Roman Empire. And this is going to be, as I said, during the period when Rome occupies Israel, that the Babylonian, Persian, Mesopotamian world is always going to be looked at as a refuge because it's going to be a more tolerant place for Jews. It's going to be the place which we mentioned previously, all the way back to the destruction of the first temple, right? This is a Jewish community there. A Jewish community which is led by this Reish Galusa guy, the head of the Galut. Remember Reish Galusa? Rosh Galut. We're going to have 43 people occupy that position from the time of the Babylonian exile till well into the Middle Ages. There's going to be a descendant. This is the parallel in Israel to the Nasi. A descendant of the house of King David from the family of Hillel, sort of royal lineage of the Jews, who is going to have, and it's interesting, in Babylon, the Nasi in Israel generally had a lot more authority within the Jewish court system of the Sanhedrin. He was the head of the president of it. The Reish Galusa did not necessarily have any authority because he was a temporal leader, a lay leader of the Jewish community. And we're often going to see at this period of time, if you look at it in more detail, that there's often going to be conflict between the leaders of the yeshivot and the Reish Galusa. And it's going to cause a lot of problems, as we'll see in a few minutes when we talk about Karaites. Okay? So we're going to have 43 people over 1,500 years are going to have that job, which says a lot about how long the Jewish community has been in Babylon. It's an amazing story. I've personally met Jews who claim to know their lineage going all the way back to the exile after the destruction of the first temple. It's the longest established diaspora community, which has been there a lot longer than the Arabs who today live in Iraq. Okay, Jewish roots in Babylon are some of the oldest community in the world. Okay, very, very interesting. And there's going to be yeshivot in Babylon that are going to last longer than any institution of higher learning that exists in the world today, even longer than places like Oxford University and Cambridge that have been around for over 700 years. Okay, so we're talking about a very stable, very old community that has a roots going way, way back in Jewish history. Yeah, you had a question in the back.
Actually, two questions.
Please.
The first question is, you said there were several different Persian empires. Were these different tribes that were conquering each other?
Not tribes, but different. The area of Mesopotamia is a large area. There are different parts of it. The Romans occupy a part of Mesopotamia. And then further to the east, you have different peoples appearing at different parts. Most of the Sasanians came, I believe, from further east, towards India. Yeah, they expand. This is the whole history. If you look, I didn't give you a class really on the history of, you know, Mesopotamian empires, but what you'll have is different groups occupying more or less the same region, and then one will grow in power, absorb other regions around them into there, like, for instance, when the Babylonians are conquered by the Persians, Persians were there. They just rise in power. This is the history of rise of empires. Rome starts out as a city-state in Italy and eventually expands to control the entire Mediterranean basin until they in turn are overrun by another group of people who walk in and who march into the air and expand. That's the history, more or less, of all empires. More or less, there's a couple of exceptions, but more or less during all of this period of time before Islam comes along. Okay, before Islam, which is already 7th century of Islam. Before Islam comes along, more or less, these empires are tolerant of the Jews. We do have examples of persecutions of Jews under certain kings. And we even have a revolt, the revolt of Marzutra, I could talk about for a couple of minutes. But more or less, it is a peaceful, tolerant coexistence that the Jews do very well in Babylon. And it's thank God, because if we didn't have Babylon, where would we go? Certainly not in the Roman Empire. It was not such a nice place for Jews. So the vast majority of Jews, we're talking about 5th, 6th, 7th centuries. The vast majority, I'm talking about 90% of the Jewish world, is going to be located in the ancient Near East, around the area of the Persian Empire, because that's where all the Jews are living, that's where the Torah is, that's where the Jewish community leaders are, that's where it's most peaceful and most prosperous for the Jewish people, which is interesting to keep in your mind, to realize that there is no major diaspora community outside Babylon until much later in Jewish history. Ashkenazic Jewry that we know of today, which is today, and certainly prior to the Holocaust, was close to 3/4 of the Jewish population of the world was Ashkenazim. The situation was exactly the opposite around, let's say, the 6th century. You had 90% of the Jewish world living over here, and then looking over here, in the ancient Near East, around the area of Iraq. A question? Okay.
Actually, I follow from the Rosh Galusa.
Sorry?
The Rosh Galusa.
Yeah.
He was saying the continuation of the descendants?
All the people who held that position claimed descendant, and it had clearly the lineage was there to be checked.
He was a secular authority.
No, he wasn't secular, meaning he wasn't a secular. There's no secular Jews at this time. There's no secular anyone at this time in history. I mean, he was secular insofar as he was not the legal halachic authority leader of the Jewish community spiritually, but rather a recognized position of nobility and a representative to the community, the larger Gentile community, and recognized by the Babylonian or Persian authorities. But you can already see where there's room for problems there, because I am the person, Reish Galusa, recognized by the authorities, yet there are, within the Jewish community, leaders of the yeshivot who are, in most cases, very big Torah scholars, and sometimes we'd have situations where the Reish Galusa wasn't such a great guy, you can have a problem with his ego running into decisions made by, halachic decisions rendered by the heads of the Jewish community, the rabbis. Yeah. Josephus writes from the period of time. I'm not sure because the date he dies, I'm not sure. He retires to Rome and writes his histories, but Josephus writes up through the period of the Great Revolt.
Do we ever get a historian like him?
No. There never was before and never was after anyone like Josephus. We have Roman historians like Deo Cassius, who lives later, who talk about the same events and talk about events after, but they're not dealing specifically with Israel. So unfortunately, would that we had a Josephus in every generation, our understanding of Jewish history would be very different. Thank God we had him at least, but if we didn't have him, it would be a huge vacuum. Most of the history we glean, we're in a period of time that's historical now, so it's not so hard. But the further back we go, the harder it is to find historical sources, and we have to piece things together, and it's much more difficult. Okay, question?
You're saying there's no secular Jews, but what happened to those Jews that became Hellenists?
First of all, Hellenistic, I'm not saying that they became pagans. They could become, Hellenized could mean, the word Hellenized could mean that we keep Shabbos and eat kosher, but we're into Greek stuff also. Like we're, you know, like ancient modern Orthodox, we're trying to synthesize the two. Hellenized could mean that I give up on Judaism completely, and I even go have that operation where I have my circumcision closed up again, ouch, and I become a pagan. I worship Greek gods. Now the Greeks weren't so frum. As pagans go, the Greeks were the least from of anyone, so to speak, the least religious. We're going to see that humanism is definitely going to come out of, you know, in Europe, much, much later in history, sort of a Greek human-centered view of the world, where religion is only marginal compared to people like the ancient Egyptians or the Persians, who were much more religious peoples. But in the ancient world, if you denied the gods' existence, etc., you'd be put to death. Okay, anything, as I mentioned previously, you know, if a Roman converted to Judaism, they're put to death. I mentioned this, right? They're put to death as atheists. Did I mention that? That was the crime. Because Jews believed in an invisible God. An invisible God means no God. We have 30,000 gods. So atheism is a capital offense everywhere we look in the ancient world. You know, Socrates had to drink poison because he had ideas that were considered heretical to Greek religion, more or less, and corrupting the youth with not in the way you think. Corrupting the youth with ideas, spiritually impure ideas. Okay, so that's, we don't have that secular stuff. Secular is a product of the last couple hundred years since the Enlightenment. Okay, now we talked about the Reish Galusa. There's also, in the chain of transmission of Torah, which has nothing to do with the Reish Galusa, we're going to go from the Amorayim. Remember Amorayim, the guys with the title Rav, who lived in both Israel and in Babylon, who put together the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud and the Yerushalmi. The bridge people between the Amorayim and the next group of rabbis called the Gaonim are a bunch of guys called the Savarayim. Okay, so we're going from Tanoim to Amorayim to Savarayim. Savarayim go from 475 to 589, 115 years. And they are at the closing of the Babylonian Talmud to the beginning of the Gaonic period in the 6th century. And they are a bridge because they're not allowed to change the text of the Talmud, but they further elucidate it. Savarayim comes from the word to explain. From 475 to 589, 115 years. Okay, so they're like the bridge between. The Talmud's already more or less closing. They don't change it, but they further work on elucidating it. It's not a period of, you don't hear too much about the Savarayim. As periods of time in history, they're like a bridge, and then it's a short period of time. And it leads us into what is a very significant period of time called the Gaonim. Now, Gaon has two meanings in Hebrew. Gaon means, you know, this is a singer, modern, Yoram Gaon. You know? But Gaon means great one. Now, Gaon could also mean, we had another Vilna Gaon who lived in the late 18th century in Vilna. Okay, that means, meaning Gaon meaning great one in terms of his genius. But the term Gaon, as we use here, are the great ones who lead the Jewish community, the halachic authorities, the rabbis who are going to run the Jewish world at this period of time. Did I mention, by the way, that smicha, I don't think I mentioned this, rabbinic ordination ceases around the time of the Bar Kochba uprising. Anyone who was a rabbi before that time, very important, was someone who was made a rabbi by someone who was made a rabbi from Moses. Okay? Which means you were direct in the line of transmission. Okay, that process ceases during the Hadrianic persecutions. The Romans outlaw it. A couple of guys get it, like Rabbi Meir, and then it stops. Okay, so the smicha, the rabbinic ordination we have today, is not the same thing. It's sort of a ke'ilu, as we say in Hebrew, like, but does not have the same authority. Such a thing, we're going to see in Sfat, much later in history, we're going to see it is revitalized for a very brief period of time in the 16th century, and then it disappears again. Two guys are going to get it. I'm not going to tell you who they are now, but it's a very interesting chapter in Jewish history, and then it stopped again.
And it was valid?
That's the reason why it stopped, because it wasn't recognized by everyone, but let's not get into that now. We say, again, at the, you know, in the, when we get our act together, Messianic era, we will be able to reinstitute such an ideology, which doesn't mean the rabbis don't have authority. They have tremendous geniuses since that time. But smicha becomes more or less a symbolic thing based on your knowledge as opposed to an actual, you are literally in the chain of transmission, like Moses does to Joshua, points him his Talmud Mufchak, his main student, his successor. That's going to stop. Okay, so the Gaonim are going to go from a period of, if you look over here, they're going to go from, they're talking about the 6th century, end of the 6th century, the last Gaon is Chai Gaon. In 1038, when he dies, that's the end of the Gaonic period. And already the authority of the Gaonim is going to have waned significantly at that period of time, and the whole Jewish community in Babylon is going to shrunk tremendously during that period of time. But there's a golden period of Gaonim during the first couple of hundred years, when the majority of Jews are living in the land of Israel, and there are a couple of people whose greatness in Torah gives them the authority to lead the Jewish community. The Gaonim also are the people who are going to head the great yeshivot. There are going to be two huge institutions of learning. If you look on your little maps over here, on primarily the Euphrates River in Mesopotamia, the little P and the S. Pumba Dissia and Sura are going to be the two centers of Jewish learning, centering around these two yeshivot that keep those names. Starting in the 3rd century, we're going to have main large centers of Jewish learning set up in Babylon. The first place it's going to be is in Nehardia, which in the 3rd century the city is destroyed and the yeshiva moves. So Nehardia is going to move to Pumba Dissia in the 4th century. And even though it's going to move after that, it's going to keep the name Pumba Dissia. It's a nice, easy name to remember, right? Just like today we have a Mir Yeshiva in Jerusalem, but the Mir is the name of a town in Poland. The Mir Yeshiva is going to move via Kobe, Japan, and Shanghai during the World War II, and it's going to end up eventually relocating to Israel, where it still keeps the name Mir, and also relocating to New York, where it keeps the name Mir. So yeshivot might move, but just like groups of Hasidim, they keep the names of their original locations as they move around. So it's important to keep in mind. So the yeshiva number one, which you'll also often hear about, is the yeshiva in Pumbedisia. So it goes from Nahardia to Pumbedisia, till eventually a place called Mechoza. Eventually it's going to end up in Baghdad. Baghdad is going to be the center of the Islamic world. Okay, going back to medieval period of time. That's yeshiva number one. And the heads of that yeshiva are going to be Gaonim. The second yeshiva is going to be in Sura. If you look on your little map, the S, a little further south on the Euphrates River. It's going to move to Maaseh Machsia, another easy name to remember. These are all going to be on the final exam. Don't worry. No, they're not. And it too will eventually move by the 11th century. It's going to be, and it's going to end up in also in Baghdad. Okay, so the yeshivas will travel around, but they're going to keep the names. And we have to appreciate that this is an unusual situation of strong central institutions of learning recognized by the entire population, with great rabbis leading them called the Gaonim. And so unified is the community going to be, they're going to do a thing called Yarkei Kala. Yarkei Kala is going to be, we still have remnants of this going on in the Jewish world. A Yarkei Kala is going to be that for several months prior to Passover and to the Yomim Neroyim, to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the yeshiva, all the students in the yeshiva, and all the graduates, the alumni, and anyone else who's interested, will all learn the same material. Okay, and then they'll get together for a week in the spring and in the fall, right around the time of the holidays, and all do a giant chazorah together. We're talking about a period of time like 12,000 students getting together to study. Can you imagine? Imagine like bring all the alumni of Eshet Torah back. They all learn for several weeks before. Everyone's learning for months before the same thing. And then they all get together to rejuvenate themselves. It's sort of a zecher, a remembrance of what the Jews would have done if the temple were standing. We'd all come to Jerusalem. There we'd have the temple. We'd be spiritually rejuvenated. In place of temple, we now have what is the central unifying factor of the Jewish people, which is Torah. And we all come and learn it together. It's an amazing idea. Can you imagine being in a place where you have literally thousands of people chazering, you know, going over the same piece of the Talmud together and learning it? So we have to appreciate how strong is the Jewish community at this period of time. So again, it's more or less a golden age for the Jewish people. There's one exception during the late 5th, early 6th centuries, during the reign of King Kavda I, the Persian king. There's persecutions of the Jews, and there's a revolt of the Resh Galusa, whose name is Marzutra. And he revolts, and he declares independence within the Persian Empire and makes a separate little Jewish kingdom. If you want to read, go get the H.H. Ben Sassoon's book. And he talks about the revolt of Marzutra, one of the few examples of a Jewish revolt in the Persian Empire. And after 7 years, you have an independent Jewish country within the Persian Empire. After 7 years, the revolt is crushed and everyone is murdered, and that's it. So you already see.
What year was that?
The actual revolt of Marzutra is in the early 6th century. The exact year, I'm not sure of. But it's one example of Persian persecution of Jews, which led to a Jewish reaction. What I want to talk about in the remaining time we have are the Karaites and Sad Yagon, okay, which is, we're not going into the personalities of the Gaonim. One of the things I don't have time to do in this class is a lot of great Torah personalities who are existing at this period of time. We don't look at that many of them because you could literally do a whole history series, great people in Torah. But I just want to talk about a few people who had a huge impact on the Jewish world as we go along. One of them is Sad Yagon. Okay, Rav Sad Yagon, who lived from 882 to 942. Okay, he is one of the great personalities of Babylonian Persian Jewish history. A man of tremendous Torah knowledge, author of some very significant works that we still study today. He, I want to mention specifically for a couple of reasons. One, there's a dispute that takes place during his lifetime regarding the calendar, which he adjudicates. He comes in and basically solves the dispute. If not, we could have had a split in the calendar. It's basically between the scholars and the rabbis in Jerusalem and the rabbis in Babylon, not agreeing on when the new month should be. He comes in, he solves the problem, and he's given the job of Rosh Yeshiva. Anyone who can solve a problem in the Jewish world like that is given the job of Rosh Yeshiva of Sura. So he's the Gaon at that period of time. But more importantly, he is known for being the person who fights against one of the earlier splinter movements in Judaism called the Karaites. I mean, I think it was Jeff was showing me a little description and about a short description of the Karaites in a little like newsletter bulletin about things going on in Jerusalem, the Karaite synagogue. Karaites based their origins on a man by the name of Anan ben David. Anan ben David, who lived in the 8th century, was a person who was descendant of the house of Hillel, who was in line to be the Reish Galusa and didn't get the job. I'm doing this very briefly. And because of that, we often see that many splinter movements in human history, especially in the Jewish world, come from ego problems. Just as we see, remember with Yerovam and Rechavam and splitting Israel into two kingdoms? Yerovam goes and becomes king in the north and then decides he likes the job and is not going to allow the Jewish people to reunify. So his desire for power and his ego caused tremendous damage to the Jewish people. Okay, here you have a great example. Anan ben David doesn't get the job, and he basically, therefore, goes off and does his own thing. Now, in his lifetime, we don't see Karaism appearing as a major movement, but by the 10th century, the century after, we see a new movement appearing within Judaism, an offshoot, a breakaway movement, called the Karaites. The Karaites, they're based, what do they attack? And they're still alive and well. There's still several tens of thousands of them. They're a mere shadow of what they were going back 1,000 years ago. But the Karaites attack. Because this is a break with mainstream Jewish world, what's always going to be attacked is going to be the rabbis and their authority. Just as the Tzaddukim, way before the Karaites, are going to attack the oral law, so too the Karaites are going to claim that the oral law is a rabbinic creation and does not have validity. We therefore will stick with a fundamentalist interpretation of the oral law, of the written law and the written law alone. This is very similar to the Tzaddukim. Okay. Now, by the way, it's impossible to live without an oral tradition because the written law is totally unclear on so many things, as I said previously. The Torah says, shecht animals, ritual slaughter, in the way I described. And it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah what that means. Put a totafos bene necha, you know, tefillin. Put this for frontless between your eyes. There's no description of what that is. You know, put a mezuzah. Mezuzah means your doorpost on your doorpost. Put a doorpost on your doorpost. What does it mean? We have no idea. So, by the way, I have an interesting article that I got from the Jerusalem Post about the Karaite community. And it describes how they work out decisions, and they have their own oral law they have invented. So they who claim there's no oral law have had to invent their own sort of oral tradition as to what all these things mean. But they call mainstream Judaism rabbinate Judaism, meaning it's rabbinical invention. We break away. And they're much stricter, by the way, in many respects than traditional Jews who have an oral Torah. When it says you don't make a fire in your house, they didn't make a fire in their house. You know that joke, how many Jewish mothers did it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is none. I'll just sit here in the dark. That's what Karaites did on the Sabbath. See, a religious Jew knows you can stoke up your fire nice and hot, and you can light your oil lamps, and you can have light Friday night and have heat. The Karaites said, no, that's a rabbinic thing, and we're going to go drop it all, and we're going to sit here in the dark. Yeah?
No, what they say.
What they say
is that there's a difference between the verbs of matlik and mavir. One means to burn. One means to light.
Exactly. Well, but the point is, they're basing it on their interpretation of the words of the Torah versus the oral tradition as to how you apply those. So when you don't have an oral tradition, you then have to go and rip the text apart and try and learn out how your own oral tradition from examining the words. Without the oral, that's exactly what they're doing. Yeah, but the Jewish law, the Torah makes diukim. We learn out oral law. You have to have principles of the oral law to learn how to derive things from the written law. I don't want to get into a whole, but they dump it. They call it rabbinic Judaism. They go off and make their own form of Judaism. They attack rabbinic Judaism, by the way. It's illegitimate. We have the true Torah here. We're the ones who are really keeping it the way it's supposed to be kept. And they become a very powerful force in the Jewish world, both in Persia and in the land of Israel. Sadia Gaon, very similar to Samson Raphael Hirsch in the 19th century, who's going to lead the spiritual counter-offensive against the Reform movement. Sadia Gaon leads he doesn't attack physically the Karaite community, but he leads the ideological counterattack. Okay? He's going to argue for the sake of the oral tradition and traditional Judaism. And he, to a large extent, is responsible for slowing down the spread of Karaism, which could have overwhelmed the entire Jewish world. In the land of Israel, and around the 10th, 11th centuries, the majority of Jews in the land of Israel were Karaites. Okay? Totally taken over. Up until World War II, you had large Karaite communities in the Crimea. Okay, they claimed to try and save themselves off that they were not actually Jewish. You know, so don't kill me. Hitler, Nazis, don't kill us because we're not the same as those guys. Of course, they were also murdered too. Today you have Karaites living in the land of Israel. If you go to Tiferet Yisrael Street, opposite Bank Mizrahi, there's a Karaite synagogue. There's a Karaite rabbi, so to speak, there. You would never recognize him as anything but an Orthodox Jew. He looks, his wife, they cover their hair. They do very similar things. There are something like 30 or so thousand Karaites left in the world, which is a fairly, and the reason why they're still around, whereas other splinter groups are disappearing or have disappeared, like the Tzaddukim, is because they are basically very religious people and lead a very religious lifestyle, and their version of Judaism totally permeates their existence. Like Orthodox Jews, they've been able to perpetuate themselves, although they're a mere shadow of what they were going back to that period of time when they were at their heyday in like the 10th, 11th centuries. But Sadrugon is the major personality involved in slowing down the spread of Karaism. Okay. The end of the period of the Gaonim is, again, 1038 with the death of High Gaon. Now, already by this period of time, we know the Jewish community in Babylon has, to a large extent, scattered. We've already gotten into, if you're keeping track of your dates, Islam has already been around for several hundred years. By the 9th century, these big yeshivot have already moved towards the end of the 9th century to Baghdad. The relationship between the Jews is and the Muslims is going to be very different from the relationship between the Jews and the Persians. Much in general, not like the Jews and the Christians, like the Crusades, not horrendous persecutions, but certainly the green pastures of Babylon, as all diaspora communities we see in Jewish history, are going to start to turn brown. And I'm not going to get into it right now because we're going to end at this point with the closing of the Gaonic period in 1038. But several centuries before 1038, and the death of High Gaon, a huge percentage of the Jewish community of what was formerly centralized in the area of Iraq is already going to move out. Where are they going to move to? They're going to stay mostly within the Muslim world, because the Muslim world, we're going to talk about Islam tomorrow and the spread of Islam, is going to spread very rapidly through North Africa, the Middle East. It's going to be stopped at the gates of the Byzantium, but it's going to spread through much of what was the Mediterranean Roman world. And they're going to be very green pastures for the Jews, including getting all the way up into Spain. So the Jewish community, when seeing that the grass is turning brown in Babylon, is going to migrate primarily to the west, okay, into North Africa, and then into Spain. So as one period, as we see, again, this is the perennial pattern of Jewish history. We see decline in the community one place, and the doors of opportunity are going to open elsewhere. And in the case of what we're talking about now, we're going to be looking at Spain. That's really going to be the next golden period of Jewish history. Okay, so we'll stop with the end of the Gaonim. And tomorrow, I have a feeling I am not going to be here. I'm sorry. Again, I have a scheduling conflict. But if I'm not here, God willing, we'll be here on Thursday, and we'll do Islam and the Golden Age of Spain.
This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.